Thank you very much for the invitation to be here. My relationship to Germany is attenuated and strained. I'll give you some biography. First of all, I'm married to a German and I have a whole German family. The other one is I actually learned German about 20 years ago, but the problem was I was a British student studying in the United States. So that meant I went along to the DAAD and said, can I have some money? Because I've done my 4 semesters and I need to go there and actually hang out with German-speaking people and then I'll be able to do it properly. And they said, no, you can't. And I said, why not? Well, because you're a Brit. So you have to apply to the British DAAD. So I said, okay. So I applied to the British DAAD and they said, no, but you're living in America. So this is when I discovered the fundamental importance of rules. And that's it. You just have a thing for rules. So we're going to talk about rules today in a different context. And this is this whole notion of austerity. I can't wait for the German translation of this book because it sounds so much better in German, right? So, Sparpolitik, die Geschichte auf eine gefährliche Idee. I mean, that just sounds really much better. So with that as an intro, what's this book all about? Before we get to the political theory of all this, it's useful to know why I'm interested in this question. And it goes something like this. As we all know, Europe is not in great fiscal health. So we have a look at the Japanese debt levels and go, thank God we're not them. But then we begin to look, well, there's Greece, of course, and there's Italy, and there's Spain. Well, Spain is actually quite low. It was 2011. It's actually up to about here now. And there seems to be a lot of debt around. But there's a puzzle in this immediately. First of all, the United States isn't in great shape, but, you know, they do have aircraft carriers, as we were talking about the other day. The United Kingdom has its own currency. That's vitally important for what's coming up now. And then, you know, there's some other places that aren't in great shape either. I mean, Greece, Ireland, Italy. Anyway, so we're in bad shape. Right. Well, what brought about this fine mess, as Laurel and Hardy, the comedians, would have us say? It's funny how no one really laughs at that picture. I think it's absolutely hysterical. I mean, look, it's perfect. Come on, look. Anyway. Now, being good academics, you'll have seen this before. And this, to me, is the heart of the crisis. The real story of the book is this. When the G20 meeting came out of Toronto in June 2010, this is the moment when it shifted from a kind of Keynesian expansion narrative towards what was called expansionary fiscal consolidation. And as somebody who's studied a lot of economics, not as an economist, but as someone who treats economics as a subject in the world, an object of study, so to speak. So I knew the Alicina literature and this sort of stuff, and I thought, oh, come on, you're not drawing on that garbage, are you? And sure enough, if you read the communique, I mean, it's chapter and verse. It's taken right out of the Alicina and Ardanga papers, the Ecofin memo behind that, all that sort of stuff. It's taken out chapter and verse. And I thought to myself, this is completely implausible. Surely we're not going to actually base policy on this. Well, it turned out we were. So then, of course, the Eurozone crisis begins to kick off, and I start to look into this. And it became apparent for me right at the start that really this is a banking crisis. There's one crisis. It started in the US in 2008. It went to Eastern Europe in 2009, the crisis we never talk about. And then it's now festering in the EU. And why is it festering here? Because we haven't been able to delever our banks. Both the Eastern Europeans and the Americans have actually successfully delevered the financial system, which is why they're in a process of bounce back. The European problem is we can't delever our banks. Why? Because we're in the euro, and that becomes a real problem. So anyway, you've all seen this before, and the standard story on this is basically as the euro is coming in, essentially, you know, there's going to be this shiny new thing called the European Central Bank. This gives everyone credibility. They all end up with Germany's credit rating. The spreads narrow. They got lots of money. And then when they stop believing it, the spreads go off the other way. I started to interview senior bankers about this and said, what's going on there? And they tell a very different story. And the story they tell is, well, look, why am I buying Greek paper at 25%? It's a thinly traded market. There's hardly any of it around. I'm not going to stuff my whole portfolio with it because it's dangerous. But it's useful for a bit of sort of distribution of assets in the portfolio. And it's a bit of a flutter. There's a whole series of bonds you can buy that's pretty good yield. I mean, and generally speaking, European sovereigns don't go bust. So that's pretty good. But I know that these things are going to start to converge. Now, why are they converging? Well, bonds only ever converge for one reason. Simply because people are buying them. So when you buy them, the price goes up and the yield goes down. Now, in order to make money off that, I need to, on a declining yield, buy more and more and more of these bonds. So I do what's called a volume convergence trade. Basically, I stuff my proverbial boots with as much of this debt as possible and lever up my balance sheet with huge amounts of debt in order to turbocharge the return I'm getting on a declining yield. Now, why would I do this? Because it's a brilliant business model to turn your bank into a systemic risk. because then your national regulator has to bail you out if you get into trouble. Now, every individual bank making this calculation thinks this is the smartest move ever, apart from you can't bail them all out at once, particularly when you've given away your currency. And that was the flaw in the plan. So when the Chancellor turns around and says, Germany can't bail this, she's not being wrong. She's right, Germany can't bail this. The whole thing is too big to bail, but it was based upon a business model which was too big to fail. And ultimately, this is all about saving the bank still. Now, evidence for this, if I can get this. I always have trouble with clickers. There we go. This is what happens when you stuff your boots with periphery debts gone bad. So basically, France is sitting with over 30% of GDP 2011 in basically toxic assets, sitting on the balance sheets of its top three banks. And its top three banks, the result is, assets held in Germany, France, and the UK are about double the annual GDP of the entire EU. But the really fun slide is this one. If that goes bad, it's game over for the euro and the core banks. There's French GDP. That's the top three banks. That's their real asset to GDP ratio. That's the size of the financial sector. They don't have a printing press. So simply just look at this on its own. If any one of those banks go bad, it's good night, Irene, for the whole system. So why are we squeezing on the Greeks to make sure that they don't leave the euro? Because if I'm holding a portfolio of mixed sovereign debt and that goes to zero, I have to make up the loss somewhere else in my portfolio. So I try and get ahead of the curve. I dump Portugal. You know I'm going to dump Portugal, so you dump Ireland. Suddenly we're all knocking on Spain's doorstep. Spain's banks are insolvent. It's that simple. Once that happens, you blow up the French economy. That's what this is really all about. Now, how do you delever that? How do you get out of that trouble? In America, they did TARP, which is basically recapitalizing the banks, take the toxic assets away, give them cash. In Eastern Europe, you did through a crushing deflation, whereby Latvian grandmothers basically guaranteed the senior bondholders of Swedish banks. We haven't done anything yet. We can't move. We're paralyzed. So what do? We turn to the ECB and say, please give us as much liquidity as possible and hope that austerity works. So do we have any reason for actually thinking that this will work? Well, the problem is, if it's all about stopping a bank run through the bond market, you've got a couple of problems that are structural. You can't solve a banking problem with budget cuts. I mean, you can cut Greek public spending to Neolithic levels. It's going to do absolutely nothing for the 37 billion euros that are sitting in Ireland's NAMA, its bad bank, never ever going to come back again. You can't run a gold standard in a democracy. I'll qualify that. You can, but eventually it will fail. This was the lesson of the 20s and the 30s. The euro is essentially a gold standard without gold. If you cannot devalue and you cannot inflate, and your only other option is default, which is the very thing you have to avoid, all you can do is deflate. That's why austerity is structurally determined. You can't solve a solvency problem with a liquidity instrument. You can try, and it's what Mario's been doing for the past 18 months. That's what the LTROs are all about, the whole thing. But the key one is this, and this is where it moves from a sort of simple structural constraint because of a banking problem into the realm of ideas. You can't all cut at once and expect to grow. For someone to be running a surplus, someone by definition has to be running a deficit. It doesn't work any other way. We can't all run a trade surplus. There's no way that this is possible. So if the idea is that there's a loss of competitiveness in these economies, which is true, if you tell the following causal story, you're going to get into trouble. They lost competitiveness and yet they had wage increases above productivity. Therefore, they have to have wage and price cuts to reduce that gap so that there's a competitive convergence. Problem, the most competitive economy in the system are you guys. And you're not going to hold still at any moment, are you? You're going to just keep getting more competitive because you have the good stuff that everybody wants to buy. And because of the euro, you have an undervalued exchange rate that means even the crappy stuff you make is globally competitive. Right? True, right? Now, if that's the case, how on earth are a bunch of checklist quasi-IMF structural adjustment, let's do this because structural reform is good, going to turn Greece into even Italy, let alone turn the Italians into the Germans? This is a fantasy. It simply cannot work. But we're going to try it anyway. Now, if that's the case, and that's the ideological story behind this, why then did anyone ever think this was a good idea? So I really wanted to think about this, and I started off talking to a political theorist about this. And he said to me, if you're looking for austerity in political theory, you're not going to find it because of one simple thing. You can't actually, even in economic theory, you can't have an argument for cutting the state being good and leading to expansion until you have a state that's big enough to cut. That was odd. until you have a state that's big enough to cut. And that doesn't happen until you get to the beginning of the 20th century. But the idea behind it is a kind of an absence. And I changed that to basically being a neuralgia that exists in liberal theory about the relationship between markets and states. So here's how I tell the story. So we start off with John Locke. Why not? Because you've got to start somewhere. The key one is John Locke's fifth chapter, if you ever read it. It's a remarkable document. He managed to invent an entire sort of theory of property, money, capital, appropriation, the whole lot, just in this one chapter. Start off with basically, God owns everything, so how can you have private property? And by the end of the chapter, you have absolutely unlimited expropriation, the beginnings of labour markets, alienation, all of it is in there. Now, the interesting thing about it is what Locke's remembered for mainly political theory is the whole right to rebel and obligation and so on and so forth. And the two of these things are often seen as a bit of a problem. What's known as the C.B. McPherson reading, the Marxist reading, it's all about property, which I subscribe to, is often juxtaposed to the rights reading. But they're actually about the same thing, because what is Locke representative of? A social faction, which is basically the proto-capitalist class of the United Kingdom, who essentially wants to take over the state, because if you want to enclose land, if you want to basically create labour markets, if you want to commodify relationships, as we call it these days, you need to run the state. This, the idea that this happens on its own is a complete fantasy, always has been. But if you run the state, you become the very thing that you fear. You become the agent of expropriation. You become the thing that perverts markets rather than perfects them. So there's this tension in Locke, and he doesn't really know how to solve it. So anyway, next one, quote the Scottish Enlightenment. What you've got here is David Hume, lovely line that he's got in his writings on this. Public credit will destroy the nation. So what's his story here? It's a similar story you get in Adam Smith. It's very interesting. Basically, he loves merchants because, you know, merchants are Locke and his ilk, and they're the people who should run things, and quite rarely, there's no democracy in this, remember, right? So these are the good guys. They're the ones that connect borrowers and savers. They make trade happen. They're basically the network of capitalism, if you want to put it that way. And this is where the problem arises, because government, you admit that you need it, right? But the problem is they like to tax you, and the only people with money are the merchants. So there's a way out. You can issue debt. But the problem with issuing debt is in order to get people to buy the debt, you have to offer better terms than you would get investing your money in the market with other merchants. So if you do this, you pervert the investment function. You end up investing in stuff which is fundamentally unproductive. And that benefits only the political classes. So you have a new form of expropriation. That becomes his argument about why this will ultimately do it. Now remember, David Hume, when he's writing his essay on money, it predicted the downfall of the United Kingdom as a sovereign power and its complete enslavement by its creditors right at the moment that it was about to dominate the entire planet for almost a century. So we have to take this with a bit of a pinch of salt. Similarly, Adam Smith, someone who's often quoted but never read, the practice of funding has gradually enfeebled every state that has adopted it. At the base of Smith's theory of accumulation in Book 2 is a moral virtue that we're basically all hardwired to be savers, and that the vast majority of us are not prodigal. We don't spend. There's a strong supply side anti-consumption bias in this right from the start. So savings leads to investment. It's not an identity, right? It's a causal relationship. Savings automatically leads to investment, leads to growth. Problem with this, he fully admits that there's massive inequality. There's a wonderful line he has in there about civil government insofar as it is instituted. It's instituted for the protection of the rich against the poor, or those who have some property against those who have none. Right? And I put that down as an exam question for students who are lazy, because they all go Karl Marx. And it's like, wrong, Adam Smith. Right? So he admits that you need the state because it generates inequality. So what do you need? You need taxes. So then you start reading Smith on taxes. Fascinating. First one, canons of proportionality. Those who are protected most by the state should be the ones who pay for it. Brilliant, proportional taxation. Problem, income skew. And then he turns around and says, but it's just like Mitt Romney, basically. You can tax the rich, but it'll never be enough. So what do we tax instead? He says luxuries. What does he mean by luxuries? Basically anything. It's a giant consumption tax that will be paid by the poor. Problem, they don't have any money. So even if you tax them in a huge consumption tax, you'll never raise enough revenue. And you're not going to tax him. So what are you going to do? You're going to issue debt. And if you issue debt, what happens? It becomes an expedient, and you fall into Hume's problem, and you generate more and more debt, and eventually the state, the very thing that guards capitalism, is ultimately what undermines it through the issue of debt. When you take these three together, these foundational thinkers, they have what I call the can't live with it, can't live without it, don't want to pay for it problem of classical liberalism. Because you either acknowledge the necessity of the state for generating markets and market society, or you just pretend it's not true. And that's pretty much the neuralgia, the split that ends up in there. The state is the antithesis of the market, and simultaneously its catalyst. So austerity emerges here, not as austerity as modern form, as an absence. The state's not big enough to cut, but it is an inevitability, because if all it does is generate debt, by definition, in order to stabilise the system, you have to cut it. The state must be permanently kept in check from its debt-raising ambitions. By the 19th century, we're really getting there. This creates two tracks to 19th century political economy. One begins with David Ricardo, actually begins with Cantillon before this, but it runs through Ricardo and basically is the can't live with it, don't want to pay for it school. The state is simply a pathology, keep it out of the way. This essentially goes into the marginalist, into Bombardier, and into the Austrian school. The other side, the chap on the right-hand side, is John Stuart Mill. And Mill, if you read him, this interesting juxtaposition of the political economy and On Liberty simultaneously published almost back to back. And in one of them, he sees democracy coming down the road. And he really doesn't know how to solve this problem. He has the marketplace of ideas. That doesn't work. He resorts to invoking men of genius. Yeah, that'll save you. There's no real solution in the book. And in the political economy, he starts off as a Smithian on debt and then begins to move to a position whereby, if properly managed, debt is the type of instrument the government can use to control the masses, as we have to accept them into the broader political economy. So he marks that moment where it begins to transit into what you call the new liberalism of the early 20th century, of Hobson and then eventually Keynes and the social reformers of that period. This leads to two camps and three responses. The first one, Mises, is the modern instantiation of the Austrian position. State bad, get it out of the way. Anything wrong in the economy, it's because the state's involved. It's completely coherent if you start with a Lockean and Smith position on debt. The other side becomes Keynes, which is essentially the opposite from exactly the same conclusion and the same neuralgia. I understand that the state's the problem, but you know what? We can't live without it. As society becomes more democratic, more complex, we need the state to manage this, and debt is just one part of the management regime. We have to accept this. Three responses in the 1920s when the crisis hits. Who's that? Schumpeter. Isn't that a brilliant picture? Because he actually looks like that, which is really scary. Now, Schumpeter's main influence, we've had a sidebar conversation about this, Wolfgang and I. Schumpeter's main influence is not when he's Austrian finance minister, and apparently he used to basically go to meetings with prostitutes. He was showing off, right? He'd drive around in a carriage with two hookers. That was the guy's style, right? While everyone else is starving after World War I. You know where this man's coming from. Now, he is associated with, in the United States, because when he leaves Austria, he becomes a professor at Harvard, with what was known as modern business cycle theory. And the two theorists in the United States were Wesley Mitchell at Columbia and Schumpeter up at Harvard. And the basic idea was completely Austrian in its modern form, and in the Mises-Hayek crisis mode. There's a long-run capital structure of the economy. You end up creating easy credit from the public sector to the private sector, doesn't matter which one. You get a perversion of the entrepreneurial investment function, once again, the old Smithian story. This leads to a massive misallocation of capital. And what you have to do is, once that bubble bursts up, blows up, you allow it to burst. And you get through it as quickly as possible, and then you have this austerity following the binge, and that resets the clock, and we get back on the path. That was the sort of the policy response of the 1920s into the 1930s, right up to the Roosevelt administration in the United States. That's one of the responses that comes out of this tradition. In Britain, you have something very similar. Sort of, as usual with the Brits, it's not nearly as vulgar as the Americans. It sounds nicer, but it's really the same thing. And this is the Treasury view. So Joan Robinson has a lovely line in a piece about this, which says, for 50 years, the doctrine was laissez-faire and laissez-faire more. You couldn't intervene, you couldn't touch anything, and it became manifestly obvious that all that they had been doing all the way through World War I was touch, touch, touch. So you have a new liberalism, you have old age pensions, you have an increased role for the state, you have bigger government borrowing, you've just fought an enormously costly war. So all of those things are de facto there. You can't pretend the state's not there any longer, but you have Winston Churchill as Chancellor of the Exchequer, basically answering Lloyd George's let's create a challenge on employment through public works with the memorandum on certain proposals on unemployment. This is the key Treasury doctrine. What they invoke there is a crowding out argument, very simple one that says anything that the government's bidding up by raising interest rates in excess of the nominal interest rate that's out there is taking capital away that otherwise would be used. Now, of course, the counterfactual is, well, would it, right? So just now companies are sitting on lots of cash, why? Because they're uncertain, etc. The Keynesian response. But also fascinating in this, they invoke Ricardian equivalence long before rational expectations theory was ever thought. And they basically said if investors see this coming, any type of public works, they will rationally discount its effect and then pervert the capital supply even further, so you get a double whammy. And the last one they said is what the Republicans said about the Obama stimulus. There just aren't enough shovel-ready projects. So all of those arguments that we've heard and continue to hear right there in the Treasury view. Now, the last one is the Keynesian one. And the Keynesian one is not the one from Keynes. Again, Joan Robinson has a beautiful line where she says, Keynes was writing it down in theory in 1936, Herr Hitler was proving it in practice in 1935. But more important there is actually the experience in Japan. The Japanese reflation under this guy, who nobody's ever heard of, Takahashi Kuriego, amazing. Think about a country that has to import its raw materials and yet is export dependent. There's a global deflation going on. Half the world's on a gold standard. Everything is deflating. This guy comes in and basically does all of the Keynesian tricks, turns the central bank into a dependent check cashing machine, basically issues lots of paper, buys its own paper, recycles a whole lot. They're growing at 4-6% a year from 1931 to 1937, while the whole of the rest of the world is going down. So this, nothing succeeds like success. Yeah, you think other fascist parties start to notice this trick? Absolutely, not just them. Who was the number one foreign economic advisor in the early Roosevelt administration under the NIRA? Mussolini's son. Literally the most frequent visitor. So what's moving along here is we've tried this austerity thing in both these flavors. It just doesn't work. Let's try something else. Unfortunately, it takes these forms, which then tie themselves into much more nationalistic and eventually genocidal and imperial projects. But what really overstands us in the long term is the simplicity of the idea. And what the Keynesian Revolution does is come along in the 1930s with Hicks and Kahn and others, and say, basically, look, you've got some problems here. The first one is fallacy of composition and scalability. Deflation is a thorny problem. The first best strategy for anyone in a deflation to protect themselves always produces a second best outcome. So if an individual worker takes a pay cut, the aggregate effect is to lower consumption. That means that the real wage has gone up without anybody actually giving them a pay increase. The rational response of the businessman, if that happens, is to go, I'm not making any money, I need to sell my stuff. Everybody sells it at once, what happens? You deflate prices even more. What have you just done? You've shrunk the economy for no gain. So these fallacies of composition mean that simply being austere on an individual rational basis is not scalable. It doesn't go all the way to the top, hence the macroeconomy. It also suggests that investment expectations were both social and had the characteristic of a prisoner's dilemma. That is to say, I don't invest because you don't invest, and you don't invest because you don't invest, and because you don't invest, you don't invest. And we're all looking at each other for signals because none of us know what's coming next. So regardless of whether there been 200 quarters of growth beforehand, once you've done this for three quarters, the discount on the time series is massive. So you have depressions because your investment expectations are depressed. Given this, what matters is the relationship between consumption and investment demand as an expectation, not savings leading to investment. Hence why the demand side ultimately has to drive it. And it really instantiates and confirms the bias of the resolution of the neuralgia, if you will, in favour of the state, because it becomes, we tried to live without it, and it caused a gigantic catastrophe. So we need to tame it and live with it, hence the post-war welfare state compromise, so on and so forth. Now, what happens at the same time with Schumpeter? Very interesting. You ever read Capitalism, Socialism, Democracy? You read little bits in grad school. You read the bit on democracy. The first 80 pages are a reply to Marx, where he wonders if Marx is a business cycle theorist. And his answer is, maybe. He never once addresses Keynesian economics, reflation, anything. So it's central now. Beverages running around the place, right? Not even spoken about. Doesn't address the New Deal other than to say Lord Keynes' ideas are one line. He says, laughable. His main story as to what's going on is bureaucracy and scale, and that socialism and capitalism are converging together, the result of which is the end of the entrepreneur, the end of bourgeois virtue, and the end of the bourgeois family, which is the vast majority of the book. what is this? Well, this is basically, you know what? All of this has gone on. The world has changed. I can adapt to this. I can join in. Many people did. I'm a real conservative. I'm not doing that. This is principle. But it's also a retreat. It's like reading John Galt at the end of Ayn Rand. If you read Galt's long speech and read Schubert, they're very similar in their form. Now, austerity's long winter. It's not dead. Where does it find a home? Who's that, everyone? Who is that? That's Walter Ucken. That's the ordo-liberal guy. Because after the war, there's this country called Germany, which had this weird late developer tradition. And after the Founders' Crisis in 1873, liberalism got a bad name. And you had that whole marriage of Hayek and Ribot, and maybe the historiography had been overdone, but you were the original developmental state. And it is all about industrial catch-up. It's about being on a technological frontier. It's about exports. It's about diversified, high-quality production. All that stuff goes back a very long way. It wasn't invented in the 1970s. But after World War II, you needed a new set of ideas. And that new set of ideas, beyond Ayn Rand, became Freiburg and its relationship to the state. The notion of the economic constitution. The centrality of competition rather than consumption. The notion of sound money plus competition producing good products which will be exported. That is why you're not Keynesians. Because once you build an economy that looks like that, reflationary economic policy and macro demand make no sense and would be counterproductive. You have a supply-side export-driven economy. That's why those ideas resonate. That's why your response to the euro crisis is exactly what it is. Now, where else? In the American imaginary. Schumpeter dies, but he never goes away. The Keynesians in the United States were odd. The neoclassical synthesis was a synthesis on terms that bolted classical ideas to Keynesian front and mathematized them out of existence, if you think about it, basically by removing all the stuff about uncertainty, etc., etc., and reducing it down to a series of simultaneous equations under Samuelson and others. But the economic tradition, the political economic tradition of the American imaginary was always one of cycles. And those cycles are impervious. Think of Robert Barrow coming back in the late 1970s, real business cycle theory, etc. Basically the same stuff in the 1920s with a lot more math. Now, when you get up to the crisis, something very interesting happens. Suddenly you got Peter Schiff, these investors, you got Alan Greenspan coming out of the closet as an Austrian. It's like, what's all this about? Well, think about how this fits into the crisis, right? What's their story? Banks, leverage, and credit extension. Beguiling the entrepreneur. Adam Smith again, all the way. The strange allure of debt. The only thing you can do is binge and purge. The only thing that you can do is deflate. And if you don't deflate, the state's going to do it through inflation, which is expropriation. Don't kid yourself on. And above all, do not intervene. The reason that we screwed up in the 1920s was because we intervened. If we hadn't have intervened, we would have come back stronger. That is an Austrian story, but it's very much an American story. It's the Tea Party story. It's the don't bail the banks story. How does this get enabled? Well, the neoliberal turn in the 1980s. Milton's a good start, but also Jim Buchanan, public choice economics. Very, very important in this regard. Think about the context of neoliberalism and fit it into this whole sort of story. It's not some exogenous shock that happens in the 70s because of the oil crisis. It's a long-run trajectory of these ideas. The key monetarist contribution wasn't actually control of inflation through the money supply. It's the notion of the natural rate. Once you have a natural rate hypothesis as your general state of the economy, you've got a structural limit to growth. Anything that you do with the government now is simply going to show up as inflation. It's in the model from the start. What does public choice do? It invents political business cycles that actually aren't there, if you look at the material. But nonetheless, this very persuasive idea that we've got inflation because if politicians are manipulating the business cycle for strategic advantage, so you end up with higher and higher inflation. Government not only causes debt, it now causes devaluation and debasement. And there's no point in spending because you'll never do anything other than just produce inflation. Democracy in such a world becomes a problem. So what's the solution? What spreads like a rash over the face of humanity in the 1980s and 1990s? Central bank independence. And whose example are we drawing from, rightly or wrongly? Right from here. Kate McNamara's book on this is right on the money. What does all this also lead to? Well, why do you want this as the solution? Because you have that whole this whole literature coming out of public choice on rules over discretion. Kirkland and Prescott, Barrow, what's his name again? Reinhard Rogoff, right, coming out in 1982. The whole notion building on top of that of agents having rational expectations. And guess what? our old friend, Ricardian equivalence, and the notion that markets are self-stabilizing when left alone, the efficient markets hypothesis. This is crowding out Keynes globally. So long before the crisis, all of the space that made that Keynesian argument possible had been shut down, one piece at a time, slowly but surely. You road test this with everybody else. We tried it before. It was basically called the Washington Consensus. Stabilize, privatize, liberalize, and cut the state. It didn't work. Two reports that were authored on this in 2003, one by the World Bank. The World Bank turned around and goes, whoa, that was a decade to be forgotten about. Maybe we should think about something else. The IMF offered a report in 2004 as a reply, authored by Ann Kruger, that gives the classic liberal justification. There's nothing wrong with the ideas, there's nothing wrong with the policies, they just didn't try hard enough. What did we say about the Greeks? Exactly the same. Who's this guy? Anybody know? It's Jacques Poulenc. Jacques Poulenc was the designer of the IMF's basic monetary model. Back in the 50s, when you're going to do exchange rate adjustments, you have to figure out when you give them money and they do an exchange rate adjustment, how the real economy is going to react. That means you have to build a model. He built the original model. They've been using it ever since. Really, there's very little change. A few more variables, that's it. In this model, it's quite brilliant. If the government spends money, it leads to a declining function in the growth coefficients. If the private sector gets into debt, it goes up. Why? Because I say so. So right at the beginning of this whole thing, you have an assumption built into the monetary model that means the so-called Keynesian IMF never was. Government spending is inherently bad given their own macro model of the economy. Now, how do we get to the modern era? Luigi Einaudi and the Bocconi School in Milan. This is the bit that I didn't know. This is fascinating. So this is the Italian paraphrase of Milton Friedman. If you get it. So basically, there is a free lunch if you skip your dinner. And that is essentially what the expansionary austerity claim really is. So where does this come from? Well, the Bocconi School, I mean, think about it this way. How many of you spent time in Italy? Eh? Go on, admit it. You can admit it, it's fine. You know what I mean? Right, okay. It's amazing that it holds together. I mean, it really does. And it's actually quite a prosperous economy. And Northern Italy itself has wonderful diversified quality products like gears and bikes and industrial air conditioners. And they make good stuff, absolutely. But the government's completely dysfunctional. Right? The main, across from the parliament, the big restaurant across from the parliament is a restaurant called The Privileged Ones. And they unabashedly sit in there and have dinner on expenses. I mean, it's beyond pathology. So if I were there, I would be a member of the Bocconi School. I understand why. But basically, what is it? Basically, this is kind of public choice, like Jim Buchanan, done in the Italian context. This is always and everywhere a pathology. It's back to that very old liberalism. The state is always and everywhere bad. It does no good whatsoever. Einaudi is actually the ordo-liberal from Italy. Very much in conversation with the post-war ordo-liberals. And writes some wonderful essays on how Europe, the very idea of Europe is a wonderful thing because it will act as a disciplinary device on individual state spending. It will act as a mechanism to cancel out these national reflationary experiments. They'll have to go to the public and tell them what they're doing, which means raising taxes and they'll never vote for it, becomes the argument. The PhD students from here are Alberto Alesina, Ardanga, Giavazzi, Pagano, and basically the entire American economic elite that writes on the role of the state in public choice. They move from Harvard, from Milan to Harvard, and you get to Alesina. It all comes together here in the series of papers. I've read every single paper in this school from 1990 onwards. I can tell you the insides and outs of it. Debt and time inconsistency, theme number one. If politicians can't be trusted because they might actually change their mind and they don't obey the rules, they're inherently time inconsistent. If they're time inconsistent, the only way to defend yourself is to basically defend yourself by being long-sighted. Luckily, voters and investors are, so we can assume Ricardian equivalence. If we have this, we know that there'll be negative income shocks in response to fiscal stimulus under constraints. This means that spending and future taxes become symmetrical. Because of this, consumers actually rationally adapt to it, and you get a version of the policy irrelevance hypothesis. Therefore, the only way you ever get out of a problem when your economy is tanking by this logic is by cutting. Why? Because if you cut severely, upfront, and on welfare and don't raise taxes, you're signalling a credible regime shift such that the expectations of investors and publics are totally altered, and they know that they will have more money in the future because they'll be paying less taxes then, and therefore they will spend now. I have been studying this stuff for 25 years. I don't even think that way. I've never met anyone who actually does outside of an economic seminar room. Most people can't tell the difference between real and nominal values. But putting that to one side, so what you want to do is cuts, not taxes. There is no alternative. And the case studies that are picked up in this literature over and over again are Ireland in the 80s, Sweden in the 90s, Canada in the 80s, Denmark and Australia. Very briefly on these, none of them work. The Irish one is entirely down to the Lawson boom and a massive export boost that went on because basically the Brits were overventilating. The Swedish one is hilarious. You know, there was a triple meltdown in stock markets, real estate, and the currency or the ERM implosion? Right, the most famous paper in this literature on this tries to turn that into the fact that the Swedish public was afraid of a sovereign default because Swedish debt had got to 62% of GDP. It's complete fantasy. I mean, it never happened, right? Well, at Canada, what happened to Canada? Well, basically, Ronald Reagan, after deflating the economy, decided to massively reflate it from 84 to 94, and that was when Canada was able to pay back a lot of debt, because 75% of its trade goes to a trading partner, which is massively expanding. In all of these cases, if you look at the econometrics, 40% of the variance is always the devaluation. All these countries have their own currency. The other 30% is an encompassing wage agreement. The residual, the unexplained residual in the coefficient, is just called the expectations effect, with no direct evidence for it whatsoever. I mean, it really is quite scandalous. Nonetheless, that's what we write in as policy. So there's the monthly bulletin of the ECB, and Elsina's Ecofin brief that takes all of this stuff and writes it straight into the policy script. From the June ECB report, it's actually presaged in the 2009 Vienna Agreement for Eastern Europe, where basically Latvian grandmothers guaranteed the senior bondholders of Swedish banks. It becomes the main argument on early Troika conditionality policies that you cut big, you cut up front, you do it on the expenditure side, you don't do taxes. It leads to the same structure of periphery bailouts, you do cuts, not tax increases. And results ultimately, and this is the tragic point, and what I call the greatest bait and switch in history. Because at the end of the day, remember why we're doing all this. Because you've got a banking problem. That's why we're doing this. At the end of the day, SocGen has got you in a bind. Because if you let them fail, they'll blow up the French economy. And you can't not let that happen, because that will blow up Deutsche Bank, who runs 86% of German GDP as its asset footprint, and has an operating leverage of 44-1. That means even with the best prudential regulations in the world and a tier 3 capital, a Basel 3 capital buffer, all you need is a 10% shock and you're basically insolvent. We have a huge structural problem. So why do we do austerity? To stop that problem happening. But it's not going to work. We know it's not going to work because it hasn't worked in the past. We know it's not going to work because Bocconi School graduates themselves, such as Ardanga, began to write papers in 2010 and 2011. Saying it's a myth, it doesn't work. Then the IMF starts to produce its own numbers. The World October WEO has negative multipliers of 1.5 and 1.7 for periphery budget cuts. That basically means if you think you're going to see a 3% contraction, back for 4.5 or 4.7. This is huge. It means that the convexity goes like this. Which is why the further they cut, the more debt that they have. You see in the paper today, if you go back just 6 months, Greek debt was meant to stabilise 100% to 120% GDP. The latest estimates has it at 200. And we're going to give them even more money that they're never going to pay back so that we can have another fantasy target that they're never going to reach. Why? Because it's better than letting the French banking system blow up. That's the reality of austerity politics. It is what the Brits used to call the ERM. The eternal recession mechanism. We will end up with more debt, not less. And the best example of this is what happened in Eastern Europe. So the Latvian miracle, right? Boom, boom, and they come back. They're 70% of where they started at the price of 15% of their labour market being abroad. They took the biggest GDP hit in modern history in any developed country, and out of that they managed to stabilise their exchange rate. Congratulations, I hope you think it was worth it. And the dirty little secret is this, they started growing again when they stopped doing austerity in 2010, but no one talks about that. They also don't talk about the fact that they've quadrupled their debt, and 4% of the labour market left the country in a 6-month period. And 90% of Latvians expect the economic situation going forward to be worse rather than better. If that's the expectation shock that you generate from this, it's not the one that Alicina thinks is going to drag us out of trouble. So the question is, why does it continue? And the question, the answer is, because what begins with the banks ends with the banks. And we haven't even begun to touch that problem. All is a huge crisis in the sovereign debt markets, but it's not a crisis of sovereigns. It's a crisis of banks. And until we realise that, there's no way out of this. On austerity will continue and continue and continue. I'm a really happy guy.